Hello there, and welcome to the Thank You Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today we are going to be continuing our History of the Reformation series. We ended last episode. I think Adam and I argued at the end where we ended, but I think we settled on 1519-ish.
That sounds right.
which is pretty good, because we're going to have to break the next like 2/3 years into two episodes, which in the first two episodes we covered like 20-year period. And things start getting serious now, because we're going to have Luther start writing a lot of material. And we're going to have the introduction of Melanchthon. And my father, Dr. Scott Keith, is back today. He's not in Canada anymore.
Hey.
And so he, as our resident Melanchthon scholar, is going to be probably carrying us through that episode, which is not going to be this one. That'll be the next one. Before we get into our main topics for today, I just want to remind everybody that we are part of the 1517 Podcast Network. Go to 1517.org/podcast to see all of our shows. We also have many blogs and videos and lots of material on the 1517 website. So if you do go visit the podcasting page to check out what we have, feel free to stop by some of the other links there. And if you're a longtime listener to the show, please consider supporting what we're doing. There's a big red donate button on that link as well. And anything you can give really does help us reach our goal for 2019. Okay, so we're about 1519. Luther's been in Wittenberg for a couple of years, and he's starting to write more is going to be the trend. We talked the last episode, the last half was about the disputations that he'd been writing in the 15 teens. And that's going to start shifting into longer works targeted not at the academic world like disputations are, but at various groups, which he'll identify at the beginning of those works. And so we have the three treatises of Luther coming up, 1520, right?
Very important.
But Adam, is there anything in that year between, 1518 and 1520 that like is pushing him to move from writing towards monks and academic audiences to now the various groups he's going to identify in these treatises?
Well, I think, at the very least, we could say he now realizes this is not just an in-house academic exercise, that there is a huge problem in the church, in its theology, its practice, and so on and so forth, and it needs to be brought to the public's attention. I think you could say that. 1520 is the signature year when he writes these three Reformation treatises: the Letter to the Christian Nobility, Babylonian Captivity of the Church, and On the Freedom of a Christian. And those are all, like you said earlier, directed at particular audiences, but they're very different than the earlier works that are all, like you said, very academic. These are more for a popular audience. And it's like, and they're Reformation historians, Luther, scholars of Luther studies, Luther biographers, there's a lot of debate. We're talking decades, if not centuries of debate over where Luther made his Reformation breakthrough, where he made his mind up to begin, as he put it in late 1520, to begin a Reformation according to Holy Scripture. So he realizes that his vocation is not just constrained to the church there in Wittenberg or the university there, but we might say Europe, Germany, just to be sure.
When two questions I'd have for you, Adam, is when do you think this happens in Luther, or do you think it's a sort of a movement, throughout time, or an evolution throughout time? And why is there such a debate?
Well, let me answer the last question first. Why is there such a debate? I think it's just because there's a long history of Luther's people who specialize in Luther. And everybody wants to get at least the month and the year right, if not the very day. So it's almost a idiosyncratic thing within Luther scholarship. But at the same time, historically speaking, it is kind of important. When did Luther decide that the call for reform needed to be heard to, let's say, the German nobility? That's important. Because it tells us a bit when Luther realizes that the church is corrupt beyond any sort of reformation. It tells us when Luther decided that, for example, in the Letter to the Christian Nobility, he argues that the church had set itself up in such a way, theologically and otherwise, so that it had walled itself off from scrutiny. So that's kind of important historically. Theologically, it's also important because, and I would say over the, from 1517 to 1520, late 1520s to early 1521, Luther starts to learn that the corruption is much deeper than he originally assumed.
Isn't there also in Luther at the time a beginning of a shift away from Augustinian righteousness to a fuller recognition of the importance of the imputed righteousness of Christ? Wasn't that in that stir?
Oh, that's the heart and soul of it.
Yeah.
So I would say that you could date that to maybe, or quite early in the, you know, in those years, 1519 is what
you
I would say.
Date it to Melanchthon pretty easily.
Yes.
Yeah.
To maybe its baccalaureate thesis at Wittenberg in 1519, where he
uses
the phrase for the first time in that I'm aware of in Reformation literature.
So I would argue that that's when Luther discovers the gospel,
mm-hmm. right.
As one book mm-hmm. title has it.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the larger program of reform, that's mm-hmm. 1519 to 1521, as he's forced to go back to his study and do all this research on the character of the papacy, the history of the church, and it's not just a theological corruption or error. It's an institutional error.
Yes.
It's formal principle of authority.
Yes.
Is problematic. He learns very quickly. And even when we get to the Reformation treatises in 1520, his on the freedom of a Christian, he still in that work prefaces that work by a letter to the Pope Leo X.
Very complimentary one.
Yeah, and it's almost like he defers to the Pope's authority. He's still hanging on to the hope that the church could reform from within. So your question, why did it take so long and why is it such a big issue? Because there's so many complicated factors in what's going on in this
reform. Well, I was going to say, in the his address to Leo at the beginning of that work, you have to go just with what is said on the page.
Yes,
right?
You do.
But it seems, if you read it, it's a little overplayed. Like it's a little. Seems to me to be a bit of hamming it up there. Like
and you've
so much deference is given at this point.
Yeah,
that it's,
and that was pretty standard for the time. But he also suggests that maybe Leo should get some new advisors.
Right. Yeah. Yeah,
his advisors.
And that's kind of what I mean. It's like you might say to some, if you had a friend who's really going down a bad path, and he's all of a sudden got a new group of friends around him, and you want to address the friend, but you say, man, you should really shake off those guys.
Yeah.
But last episode, we talked about the difference between the radical and the conservative Reformation.
Yeah.
This is, Luther's no revolutionary. He's very cautious.
Yep.
Always, I think the last thing we talked about last episode was Luther's certainty. And Luther's always asking himself the question in these years, and even thereafter, am I the only one that's wise? I'm the only one who's seeing this? Because he wants to make sure, because he knows revolution, rebelling against long traditions of authority can be very dangerous.
Yeah,
he'll see that very quickly with the Thomas Munzer and the Peasant Rebellion in the
mid-1520s. In a lot of ways, what he's arguing against in the address to the Christian nobility, that's where he's arguing about this tension, right? That the state's not to determine what the church teaches, but at the same time, what hand does the state play in this evolution of how the church is working and how the people are intercounting with the teachings of the church.
And many Luther scholars have said, what you said, Adam, that Luther was no revolutionary, that one of his deepest fears was anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it makes sense when you read what happened during the Peasants' Revolt and contrast it with Munzer and the Anabaptist movement. Luther wasn't interested in a revolution at all.
Well, and if anybody's ever read some of the outlandish things that Luther can write against the Pope, I mean, keep reading, because pretty soon the rebels, the Anabaptists, are going to get even more fire from him.
Yep.
In a lot of ways, even later Reformation, it seems like the quote-unquote enemies shifted, too. I mean, so much of the writing, as you get into the 15... late 1530s, early 1540s is against the Anabaptists.
Yep.
And I think it's 1542 or 43, he writes a preface to a work where he lists out his enemies. And it's everybody.
Yeah, everybody. It's everybody.
The monstrosity of Anabaptists, the Unitarians, the party of Servetus, Michael Servetus, the Unitarian, the Jews, of course, the Papists, and then he adds to it the Turks. But so it's Luther against the world in many ways.
Right.
And I, early on, he wanted to be, it seems he wanted to be cautious of that. You know, again, he's asking the question, why am I the only one that's seeing this? Or why am I and Philip the only one seeing that everybody has interpreted the text of Scripture wrongly?
Yeah, and his Roman Catholic protagonist raised the question, why you? We have 800 that disagree with you on it. Mm-hmm.
And in that context, the question becomes, you know, where was your church before Luther? And that becomes a major polemical point of the Catholic Church very early
innovating.
On. Innovation is revolutionary. It's dangerous.
Well, and then explains all of your confessional documents get prefaced with creeds and with earlier, with the early church.
Yeah, they had to face that they were being charged with being innovators. Yeah.
Well, you have a hard time reading the Augsburg Confession. So, we're fast-forwarding 10 years here from where we're supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, we're jumping around.
But that's 1530. You have a hard time reading the Augsburg Confession without seeing a defense against the idea that we're innovators. Mm-hmm. Right from Article 1. Once you're on to this theme, I mean, that theme persists article by article. And at every point, trying to make references to somewhere in the past where this same idea was taught within the church. And was it taught and accepted within the church?
Mm-hmm. Well, and hopping back, I mean, one of the things you can note when you look at, say, disputations like the Heidelberg Disputation and then jump forward to things like Augsburg is you can see the theme and the ordering of the doctrines and the concerns is consistent, right? So like these concerns that they're eventually going to defend as creedal Orthodox Christianity in Augsburg has been something he's been working on since 1517. Especially when one of the papers I did highlighted exactly like four points that follow through Augsburg and Heidelberg, that they're examining the law of God very closely. They're examining the Trinity, what happens in the death and resurrection of Christ, and then how and who that's supposed to be proclaimed to. And, you kind of got to see this as a continuous issue, that same points are being repeated.
I think of, in prep for my doctoral work at Strasbourg, I outlined Chemnitz's on the two natures. Now, there are certain chapters that I just simply omitted. Why? Because they were catalogs of quotations from the early church, and he threw those in there, on the point that I've been making. Here's a whole chapter gathering together quotations from the fathers to show again we're not innovating.
Yeah, and that's much later. I mean, I don't know the exact date of Two Natures, but I'm thinking it's after 1570.
Yeah, it could be.
It's at least much later than the conversation we're having now.
Sure.
This is, so I guess what I'm saying is 50 years possibly go by, and that's still the question.
Yes.
Right, can you imagine that now? Like 50 years go by, and it's still the question, are you innovating?
Yes.
Well, and that gets to, what we talked about last time. There is a deep concern with, is what we're stating true? Not true to me, not true to you, actually true. Like, should everybody in Germany, everybody in Europe, everybody in the world be expressing the faith like this? Mm-hmm. And that was a real concern. And I think just a lot of people today are going to, find that as a stumbling. Like, why not just stop in your own city or with your own churches? It mattered that the truth was being taught everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and think of what Augsburg pretended to be. It pretended to be a document for the whole Christian church on earth.
So let's now just jump to 1520. The first treatise is the Address to the Christian Nobility. What is the actual power dynamic between nobles and sort of your general German populace?
In Germany, it's a mess. We're talking hundreds. Germany is, it won't be for centuries there afterwards, a united nation, if you will. It is broken down into small little dukedoms and or duchies and principalities, and some are free imperial cities and so on.
And kicked around by everybody and anybody.
It's terribly disunited. In Wittenberg, or in Saxony, electoral Saxony at least, that's an important territory because the prince there has a say in who becomes emperor. And so therefore, in terms of hierarchy, if you will, has a little more authority in terms of the Holy Roman Empire, the German nation, and so on. So when Luther appeals to the Christian nobility in early 1520, that's not insignificant in terms of its scope.
So, I mean, he's in part then basically saying, or the worry is that what he's writing could influence the decision power of an elector.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, he in that work, I mean, a short version of the argument, a very short version, is that Luther says the church, while he would prefer that the church itself clean up its act, it can't do it because he talks about three walls it's built around itself. You know, only the Pope can interpret Scripture. Councils, church councils have no input, and only the Pope can call a council anyway, and so on. It says because it can't clean up its own act, and because we know from the text of Holy Scripture that the church is in error theologically and otherwise, he appeals almost as out of necessity. He wouldn't prefer it be done this way, but out of necessity that the secular leaders step in and correct the abuses.
And so you're balancing the power between the Holy Roman Emperor and the Pope then, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a two-prong pieces of, higher power to appeal to. So what's how does the relationship between the Emperor and the Pope functionally work?
Do you have 15 hours?
Yeah.
It's a long and complicated issue. Let's go back, if you will allow me, to, let's say, 800 AD with the court.
We're going back a bit.
Well, because this
is getting a time
everything
machine
up.
Right now.
We're talking Charlemagne,
yes.
the so-called father of Europe, the first after several hundred years to be named the Roman Emperor, and later on a new adjective, the Holy Roman Empire. And another thing will be added of the German nation down the line historically. But it's not clear. Throughout the course of the Middle Ages, there's this constant debate and tension between church and state, which has priority. If you go to the coronation of Charlemagne, it's Christmas Day, 800 AD, some say Christmas Eve, who knows. But Charlemagne's there in Rome. Pope Leo III comes out, and the way that Charlemagne's biographer puts it, it's as if Charlemagne had no clue this was going to happen. But the Pope comes out and puts a crown on Charlemagne's head, symbolically suggesting that the Pope has the right to distribute
ordained kings.
Secular authority below them.
And by the time of the Middle Ages, it's very clear what Luther's up against. And all you have to do is think of how the Pope was presented in artwork. He has the shepherd's staff in one hand, and what does he have in the other hand? Well,
usually a sword.
Usually a sword.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking of the ones where he carries a globe.
Globe.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
The medieval view was he is the ruler over both realms, whether they recognize it or not. He is.
Yeah, yeah, that tradition goes way back. I don't know if it's the earliest, but from what I know, the earliest you can trace it to the late 5th century. It's Pope Gelasius and the Two Swords Doctrine. Mm-hmm. It's based off a real odd reading of Luke chapter 22, where Jesus tells Peter, or after he's told the disciples that things are going to get tough, so watch out. And Peter, or the apostle, is named in Luke, not Peter himself, but the just apostle, picks up a sword.
Yes.
Or two swords, rather. And Jesus responds to that apostle, whoever it was, it's presumed that it was Peter.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough. And the way that Pope Gelasius, he's like 492 to 496 AD, interprets that in subsequent interpretations is that the papacy, the Holy Roman Pontiff, wields both the authority in both realms,
yep,
secular and sacred.
Yep.
Now, the Pope can decide to, and this is what happens in the High Middle Ages, he hands off secular authority, that secular sword, the globe, to earthly authorities because the spiritual is occupies his business enough, right? So there's this, throughout the Middle Ages, let's say 1000, all the way up until Luther's time, there's always this question, who's the final authority in this hierarchy? And you've got lots of contestants. Think of Dante of the Inferno, or the Divine Comedy, right? And he will suggest that actually God hands down authority to both. They're both equal, the Pope and the Emperor. Marcellus of Padua, and if you're called a Marcellian in Luther's day and age, that's basically tantamount to being called a heretic. He argues that actually God hands down to the people authority, and the people decide as a spiritual people who they're what the church hierarchy will be, and as secular people,
here's the princes and kings.
And then you've got dear old Thomas Aquinas. Who's going to really confuse the issue in a work called On Kingship, where he will suggest that the king and by extension the emperor is the final secular authority, but at the same time will say that the pope might be a little bit above. So it's a open question throughout the Middle Ages. When you get to the 16th
century... Aquinas is hedging his bets a little bit.
Well,
it's maybe a little more than the king.
It's hard to say with Thomas when it comes to these sorts of things, but when you get to the 16th century, it's... The presumption is that the Pope, and this goes back to a papal bull, Unum Sanctum, 1302, where Pope Boniface VIII argues that the final authority, every human being, must be subject to the Holy Roman Pontiff.
Yeah, there it is.
And so there is this, I sometimes refer to it as a unilateral hierarchy, where kings and the emperor are all underneath the pope. Because that, I mean, if you assume all the stuff they assumed, it makes sense because the pope is the vicar of Christ.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
He's the heir of St. Peter. But that is still a contested issue, though. There are some who argued otherwise in the 16th century. Where did Charles V fit? Charles V was a loyal son of the church. But he believed that his jurisdiction extended throughout all of Christendom. And he would defer to the papacy on spiritual matters, but when it came to secular matters, going to war with the Turks, for example, or cleaning up insurrection rebellion within the Christian lands, the secular side of things, that was his...
Which is why later on, essentially the Pope ends up having to wait until the Emperor is ready to mm-hmm. come north for the small Catholic wars until they can work out how much money can be given to raise an army and all this kind of thing. But at the end of the day, it's the emperor who's going to raise the army. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, the emperor is going to march that army north and take care of things.
Yeah, the pope would legitimize a crusade, for example, but the person who
absolve
leads it,
the soldiers,
raises the money and so on is the emperor mm-hmm. and his minions.
Yeah. So again, just to tie it back to Luther, that if he manages to sort of gain support in his writings to challenge sort of the teachings of the Pope and the Church, this is really dangerous for sort of the power dynamics that trickle down to everyone. So this is sort of a risky move that he may not even be calculating like the full impact of how this could come down on him. In fact, he's probably not at this point.
That's the thing with Luther. It's not that he didn't care, but he was so interested in what is true. Yeah. Or maybe we could say good, true, and beautiful, whatever.
Yeah. Can we just say true?
yeah.
Sure, that works. he was willing to risk it all. That's where he stands. That's why he stands out. That's why so many historians and biographers have paid so close attention to him for centuries now.
Yeah.
He's not like Erasmus, who will waffle.
Yeah.
Or even like the later Melanchthon, who's certainly not known for risking it all for what's true later on.
Mm-mm. Yeah. It puts it all on the line. And back to the year 1520, at the end of the year, I think it's early December, he will, if you will, give the last sign of his attempt to stay with Rome mm-hmm. When he, with some students, a march out just towards a corner of Wittenberg with the Bull of Excommunication and a whole bunch of other paperwork,
yeah.
The you know, the canon law and so on, and burn them and refer to it as a bill of divorce. That's where he's made his mind up earlier, but now he realizes that he can't work within the institution itself.
All right. So second treatise. This is one that we've talked about on the show quite a bit. The Freedom of the Christian. This is going to probably be celebrated by 1517 in next year, in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Little hint.
Yeah.
And
lots of celebrations.
Yeah, lots of celebrations.
If I have non-Lutherans that come to me and they want to know in kind of short order, who are we, what are we, first of all, I, of course, mention the Small Catechism. Get it and read it. It's short. It's a great book of the Western world. The Calvinistic confessions are not. Start with the Catechism. And the other one that I recommend is On Christian Liberty, or what's it also titled in English?
The
Freedom of the Christian. Christian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is, some of the material in here starts some of the basis for how we talk about vocation and sort of, you know, not being totally captive to questioning, is everything a sin when we, you know, do our jobs and things like that. It's kind of...
Absolutely includes those, but the basic setup of the book is he's going to try to defend two seemingly contradictory theses. First of all, that the Christian is lorded over by nobody. And then, secondly, that the Christian is subject to his neighbor all the time. That's the setup for the book, the two theses. And he said, I'm going to try and say that they're biblical and that they're not contradictory. It's a great description biblically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Robert Kolb, a great probably one of the greatest Reformation scholars in the 20th and 21st century, mm-hmm. says that in that work, Luther is describing the Christian life as cruciform.
Yep.
Before God, it's, you know, righteousness is an accomplished fact.
Yep.
It's passively received. God gives it to you or imputes it to you.
Yep.
Through His Son, but before man, before the world, righteousness is pursued actively. That you're subject to the obligations of your vocation, whether it's mother, father, or soldier, or mm-hmm. citizen, or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems almost, I know you like this word, paradoxical, but Luther's argument that it's not paradoxical, it's biblical. This is what the Bible would teach.
Yeah, I got burned by paradox when I was at Liberal Lutheran Seminary, and they danced and rejoiced at it.
Yeah, and trotted out as an answer to everything that can't be true.
Yeah.
And reveling in contradiction.
Yeah, and here I was as a science major thinking, are you crazy?
Yeah.
So I have to make room for it in certain instances, but it's not a catch-all basket for me.
And this is the first, I mean, probably the first time in long-form writing, not in the disputation where you get a line maybe of it, where the doctrine of justification is really addressed, right, like in full. Because you have pieces of it here and there, maybe one or two sentences, but this, now you're
here
getting whole
out.
Works dedicated to it.
Yeah, and in a simple work, one that is not convoluted, academic, or anything like it. Very straightforward, can be read in not very long. And, you know, again, is one of those that sums up what we are, who we are, very quickly.
So then the third treatise, The Babylonian Captivity of the Church, is going to deal with both of these issues that are contained in here, but this is addressed to a very different audience than Christian freedom or nobility, right? Who are we talking to?
We're talking to the Church of Rome in particular.
Yep.
It's his...
it's a charge.
Critique of the Roman view, the Church of Rome's view that there are seven sacraments, and an argument for that there are two that can be biblically supported, baptism and the Lord's Supper, perhaps absolution too. The Augsburg Confession will add that too.
And Rome is holding, it's one of the ways Rome holds us in bondage. That is, they were the spigot of grace. They turn it on and turn it off, and Luther's going to go up against that with everything he's got.
I've often taught students, and as I'm thinking about it, I think it's accurate, and I hope it has been, that we sort of sometimes teach that Roman Catholicism is synergistic in the sense where it's sort of that, you know, God does what he does and moves towards you, and you have to do what you do in moving towards God. And we sometimes will say by that you have to do good works or whatever. And based on this and other things, that my view of that is that the church didn't necessarily teach that you had to go out and do what we would normally consider good works in order to be saved. Like, maybe. Like, you know, helping old ladies cross the street with their groceries and whatnot. That's not what they're talking about. They're more talking about active participation in the sacraments of the church, and that you earn your way through sort of your life of checking the sacraments off of the salvation checklist, and that those are the good works that you're actually doing, and that that is how the church held the people in captive, because literally, if you didn't check every single one of those off the list,
you're missing grace.
You're missing grace.
Yeah.
And your salvation is certainly in question.
When I'm faced with something like that, and not being the historian that Adam is, I go to the old Baltimore Catechism.
Right. And
which
that's
is Trent for kids.
Yeah, well, see, that's where I went with this based on your recommendation. And I think it's accurate. I mean, I'd be open to correction on this, but the reality seems to be, especially in that, I guess I'd call it now the older view, because if you say this, if I say this to modern Catholics, they mostly object.
Yeah.
But in this older view, that really what the church is demanding is your life checking off the list of the sacraments, right? Were you baptized? Were you confirmed? Did you have communion?
Did you get married?
Were you married in the church? Or if you're not getting get married in the church, right? Because it seems like there was two options: get married in the church
or
join one of the holy orders.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth, up to last rites or extreme unction.
Yeah, so your whole life.
Yeah. I mean, from birth to death. And in some ways, there's some beauty to that.
Sure, there is. You know, they're very clever.
Yeah. Well, and even if the church isn't lording it over you, there's also some beauty in, you know, the church walking alongside you throughout the stages of your life.
Yes, and yes, I agree.
But if the church is using this as like a power game over you, you know, have you yet confessed all your sins, and are you extremely sorry and willing to do penance for these things? You know, that type of thing. And I think Luther's on to that here, and I think that he is very much, his recognition of the two sacraments that he recognizes here are the two that can easily be said are wholly yours without you doing anything there.
If rightly presented, biblically presented, that's what it should be.
The water falls over you in connection to the word, usually in his case when you're a baby at baptism.
Yep.
And upon hearing the gifts in the service at church, you then also receive the gifts in bodily form as well. You know, and this, it's all reception, whereas the other ones, especially as presented by Rome at the time, are not all reception. They're
not at all.
They're doing.
Yep.
They're doing good works.
Yep.
Can I ask you a question, but it's sort of in the form of a thesis that you can correct. When I read this and I compare it to Luther's earlier 15 teens work, and then one year later, Melanchthon's Loci, this is out of all the treatises where in all of the early works of Luther, where I see the heaviest hand of Melanchthon's thought, or at least maybe some cooperation of ideas here, because it seems that Luther's sort of not only formulated his change on justification, but the way that grace operates has shifted significantly here, which is something that gets defined by Melanchthon here.
Yeah, it's all declarative, you know, on God's part to you. It's all, yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it. So I know I'm, just because of gymnastics and beating it in my head, I'm always wary of making an argument from influence because it's such a difficult thing to prove.
Absolutely.
But, you know, there's no doubt that the later you get into this, I'd say that maybe stops at some point. But the later you get into this, up to early 1530s, there's no doubt that they're working hand in hand daily.
Yeah, well, at least at the very least, these ideas sync between them.
Yeah,
right.
And to be fair to Luther, Melanchthon's not the only one who's getting these bouncing these things off of. In fact, even as he's translating his Bible into German, he's gathered around himself what he calls his Sanhedrin, his group of people that he defers to on some issues. He'll particularly note that for Melanchthon, he defers on Greek and he defers on the definition of words. So you could, as Luther notes that, you could maybe draw that in there. But Melanchthon's not the only one. Justice Jonas is in there and some other lesser known characters.
Scott, what do you make of the book that's sort of on this single thesis, how Melanchthon helped Luther discover the gospel? Was it Lowell Green?
Yeah, that's Lowell C. Green. One, good luck finding it and not paying.
It's like $200.
Yeah, I'd say at least $100 for it at this point. Just as a side note, I'd really like to get the rights to be the printer for that at some point. But I think Lowell's argument in there is brilliant and it's well done. He's the one that first points out that it was Melanchthon who first uses imputation in 1519 prior to anything we have written by Luther.
Yep.
Same Lowell Green's the one that points that out. He's a brilliant man and a bit of a unsung character in our circles. Faithful LCMS pastor.
Yep.
His whole life, and not as well known as say like a name like Bob Kolb or something like that. And I'm sure there's reasons for that I'm unaware of, but that book is phenomenal, and it makes this early argument. It is, in a lot of ways, obviously from the title, an argument from influence. That's why I brought it up. Which is hard, but Lowell had the training to do that in a way that
few of us do.
I wouldn't say I do.
Yeah.
I was trained to be careful of it.
Yeah. Well, Lewis had that same theme. You're going to have more than a psychological argument.
Yeah.
It can't carry the day. You've got to have something factual.
I think
you can't just argue from psych.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I don't know how strong of an argument you can make from grammar, but there is a shift in the words being used in the text. I mean, like Dr. Green pointed out with the imputation. I mean, if you look at all of the teens' writings, Luther is not using imputation. There's a change.
Yep. Yeah, this may be a transition to the next episode, but I think it would be easy enough to say that Melanchthon, especially early on, still here, didn't have to play by the same rules that Luther did with language. He wasn't in an order, right? He wasn't
right.
This early stage in August.
Subject to discipline.
Yeah, an Augustinian like Luther is. At any point, he is a grammarian.
Humanist.
And he's looking at the words in Greek and saying, and not just saying, because he's a classicist too, he's not just saying, oh, in the Koine Greek of the New Testament, this is what it says. He can tell you, you know, all the classical references that have used this word and how it was used by, you know, Cicero or how it was used by whoever.
Amazing.
And go through it and then come to a conclusion about Paul's likely use of it. And that gets him in trouble later for sure. I think it gets him in trouble. But at this point in time, it could very well cause a shift in the language of the Reformation from one that's, you know,
or at least the people teaching in the same department at the very least.
I mean, think of if you went from an understanding and even a Lutheran use of something or another to somebody just coming along who's, in a sense, outside. Melanchthon was Roman Catholic and all that, so that's not absolutely true. But from the outside comes in and says, well, this is just what the Greek says. It says it like this. You got a lot of in-house language that you're using over here, and the Greek just says this.
Yeah, I mean, he could easily say, you know, when it comes to, say, grace as an example, grace is not an object, which
I mean, sometimes I think theology students experience this a little bit when they go from their systematics class to like their New Testament Book of the Bible class, and you have a systematics prof teaching something, and they're using, you know, Paul in Romans and Peter and da-da-da, and then all of a sudden your New Testament prof goes, oh, well, geez, when Paul uses that word, this is the actual word, and it actually just means this. I mean, you get a little bit of a sense of that.
Back in the day, a lot of us thanked God for Arndt and Gingrich's lexicon that traced word usage in the first century secular as well as Christian usage and boiled it all down to four pages. I mean, that was like a gift from heaven.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's one of the crazy thing. We are transitioning into the next episode, and it was great that we sort of ended on Melanchthon here because we're going to pick up with him for the next episode. But it's amazing to think that they were able to keep track of all of these words, all these lexicons, all these usages throughout the classical word, the church, without computers. That's just like, to me, that's...
Yeah. Well, again, you know, every time we get into this, I have to remind you that they did not have TV or internet.
Yeah.
So. They did have a book wheel, though.
Yeah.
In the Renaissance, they had these like little Ferris wheels where they put multiple books, so a scholar could look at one book, and rather than having to go to the bookshelf, he could just turn the wheel to the next book.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I wonder,
build a book wheel for the podcast studio.
If you gave Melanchthon a computer with all of the documents that we have now, how much more he could have accomplished?
Yeah. Oh, don't even ask.
Or less, because maybe he'd get hooked on some Marvel show and just binge watch Netflix instead. Yeah. I mean, who knows? Yeah.
I want to mention Alistair McGrath and his work on the Reformation regarding grace. He says, I'm sure there have been others who have said it, that what we see going on in the 15-teens and early 1520 is a complete redefinition of grace from it being a substance, I think you referred to that, to now God's disposition towards humanity.
In Roman circles?
No. This is in Luther and...
In the Reformation.
Okay.
The linguistic
turn. Like you said, McGrath's not alone on that. I mean, the sacraments are so important because that's the mechanism the church uses to dole out this substance that we call
the spigot.
You know, and if the language is different, you know, you have to then ask, what is a sacrament, right? If grace is not this substance doled out by the church and it's an attitude on the part of God, what then is a sacrament? And that becomes a huge question.
Yep. McGrath is a great popularizer of all the scholarly work on this particular thing.
He really is.
His books are great, and some of them are really helpful when you're doing scholarship as a Lutheran, because he is not, and he's not in the United States either. He's in the UK, so he's not fighting any of the battles we fight in our church.
And Caleb's advisors at Nottingham will let him use McGrath, but not others.
Yeah, they won't.
If it's got the spelling starts P-R-E, something, it's R-P-R-U. How do you spell Price?
Well, let me just mention another source, one of the finest reformed sources, Richard Muller.
Yeah, he's amazing.
And they're only really, to Richard, there are only really two options, classical reformed or classical confessional Lutheran. But he does that dictionary of Latin and
Greek theological
terms. I mean, it's just a masterpiece.
Oh, it's an awesome.
Just a masterpiece. Yeah. Richard Muller.
I don't want to speak wrong of his history, but wasn't he LCMS before he went reformed?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought
yes.
It was.
And if you're listening to this and you're a student or if you're a seminarian, you should really own that book.
Yes.
Because, you know, if you haven't learned any Latin or you've learned a little Greek, this is actually going to help you understand phrases that you come across that aren't untranslated and sort of the important works you should be doing.
Mm. Well, I don't usually recommend ebooks over printed books, but this is one
in
ebook format that is searchable. It makes it really easy. It's not necessarily a book you can sit down and read cover to cover.
No.
What is this ebook thing you're talking about?
It's a digital thing that happens on your antiquated phone.
Well, before Adam dates us too much, we should probably close up this episode.
It's like a book wheel for the 21st century.
Oh, now I understand. Okay.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Thinking Fellows. I hope that people are finding this historical walkthrough helpful. Like I said, this is actually sort of, in many ways, hitting the goals I had for this series, as we've been able to talk about various doctrines, talk about the expressionist history and the way it's sort of evolved. And, you know, I think this will be a valuable resource to non-Lutherans as well. This isn't sort of like an exercise in patting our Lutheran ego. So it's a lot of fun. Thanks for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time.